How many could you see? Asked Radha, his interest caught by Ongist's question.
I could see only the leader clearly. Why? How many did he say he had?
He didn't say, answered Ongist, but I know.
Curse on you!
Shouted Tostig, storming to the other side of the clearing. Drada took Ongist by the arm and led him to the fallen trunk where Caswellan had made their fire. The two men sat down, and Drada rubbed his eyes.
What was the point of all that?
He asked.
There were no 20 clansmen, sneered Ongist. Just the one. The same man. I'd stake my life on it.
You are probably right, Drada agreed. Did he give a name?
Caswellan of the Fallen.
Caswellan. Let's hope there are not too many like him among the clans.
It won't matter if there are. Who can stand against 30,000 Aenir warriors?
That is true, agreed Drada. But they remain an unknown quantity. Who knows how many there are? Our estimate is less than 7,000 fighting men if all the clans muster. But suppose we are wrong.
What do you suggest?
I think we ought to deal with them gently.
Trade first and earn a welcome among them.
Then we'll see.
You think they'll be foolish enough to allow us into the mountains? Asked Ongist. Why not? Every other conquered nation has given us the same facility, and there must be those among the clans who are disenchanted, overlooked, or despised.
They will come to us.
And they will learn. I thought father wanted to attack in the summer.
He does, but I'll talk him out of it. There are 3 main lowland areas still to fall, and they'll yield richer pickings than these mountains.
I like the mountains. I'd like to build a home here, said Ongist.
You will, soon, my brother.
I promise you.
Oracle sat alone, gazing into the fire, lost in yesterday's dreams, when armies swept across the land with their lances gleaming and banners raised. A red hawk on a field of black. The outlanders streaming from the battlefield, broken and demoralized. Sigarni raising her sword in the sunset. The battle queen triumphant. Such had been the glory of youth when Oracle crossed the gate to the kingdom beyond. The old man drew his grey cloak about his shoulders, stretching his legs forward, soaking in the heat from the burning beech in the hearth. He stared down at the backs of his hands, wrinkled and spotted with the drab brown specks of age. But once upon a time...
Dreaming of glory?
Asked Taliesin. Oracle jerked up as if struck, twisting in his seat. He cursed softly as he recognized the ancient druid.
Pull up a chair,
he said. The druid was small and skeletally thin, his white hair and beard sparse and wispy, clinging to his face and head like remnants of winter mist. But his eyes were strangely youthful and humorous, antelope brown and set close together under sharp brows. From his skinny shoulders hung a cloak of bird's feathers, many-hued, the blue of the kingfisher flashing against raven black, soft pale plover, and eagle's quill. He leaned his long staff against the cave wall and seated himself beside the oracle.
The boy came then,
said the druid, his voice soft and deep.
You know he did.
Yes,
so it begins, the destruction of all that we love. So you believe. Do you doubt me, oracle? The future is like soft clay to be moulded. I cannot believe it is already set and decided.
The druid gave a low curse.
You of all men should know that the past, present, and future exist together, woven like cloth interweaving. You crossed the gate. Did you learn nothing? I learned the error of pride. That was enough for me. You look old and tired,
said the druid.
I am both. How is it that you still live, Taliesin? You were old when I was a babe at the breast. I was old when your grandfather was a babe at the breast.
For a while, both men sat in silence, staring into the flames, Then Oracle sighed and shifted in his seat.
"Why have you come here?"
he whispered.
"Sigourney has crossed the gate. She's at the cave on Hydruin."
Oracle licked his lips, his mouth suddenly dry.
"How is the girl?"
Taliesin gave a dry laugh.
"Girl? She's a woman near as old as you. As I said, you do not understand the intricacies of the gateways. Well, how is she anyway, damn you?"
"Gravely wounded, but I will heal her."
"May I see her?"
The druid shook his head.
"It would not be wise."
"Then why come to me at all?"
"It may be that you can help me."
"In what way?"
"What happened to the sword you stole from her?"
Oracle reddened.
"It was payment for all I had done for her. Do not seek to justify yourself, Caracas. Your sin led to more wars. You cost Sigourney far more than you were worth. Then you stole Scalivar. You told me you lost it in the fight that brought you back to us, but I no longer believe you. What happened to it?"
Oracle rose and walked to the rear of the cave. He returned, carrying a long bundle wrapped in cloth. Placing it on the table, he untied the binding and opened the bundle. There lay a shining sword of silver steel.
"You want it?"
Oracle asked. Taliesin sighed and flipped the cloth back over the blade.
"No, damn you, man. You crossed the lines of time. You will die and never know the chaos you gave birth to. I've tried to put it right. I've only succeeded in creating fresh paradoxes."
"What are you talking about?"
"Without the sword, Sigourney was crushed, defeated, and slain. But you said she was here, as she is. I tried to help her, Caracas, but she died. I crossed the lines, finding another Sigourney in another world. She died. Time and time again, I travelled the gates. Always she died. I gave up for a long while. Then I returned to my quest and found another Sigourney who was fated to die young. She defeated her first enemy, and then the second, Earl Yastai. She did it with the help of Caracas. You remember that, do you not?"
Oracle looked away.
"And Caracas, once again, stole her sword. But this time, she asked me to return it to her. That had never happened before. I did not know what to do. And now, suddenly, she is here. A victorious queen carrying this sword. I did not want to part with it,"
whispered the man who had been Caracas.
"You had such talents, Caracas," said Taliesin softly. "How was it that you became such a wretch?"
"I wanted to be a king, a hero. I wanted songs sung about me and legends written. Is that so shameful? Tell me, did she rule well? She won the final battle and held the clans together for 40 years. She's a true legend and will remain so."
Oracle grinned.
40 years, you see, and she won.
Hauling himself to his feet, the old man fetched a jug of honey mead and 2 goblets.
"Will you join me?" "I think I will." 40 years,
said Oracle again.
"I could not have done it. 40 years. Tell me of the boy Galen."
Oracle dragged his mind back to the present.
"Galen? He's a good lad, bright and quick. He has courage. I like him. He will be good for Caswallon. How does Caswallon fare?" "As always, he walks his own path. He's been good to me, like a son. And he eases my shame, and helps me forget."
"Have you told him of your past?" inquired Taliesin, leaning forward and staring hard at Oracle.
"No. I kept my promises. I've told no one of the worlds beyond.
Do you doubt me?"
"I do not. You are a willful man and proud. But no one has ever accused you of oath-breaking."
"Then why ask?"
"Because men change. They grow weak, senile. I am not senile yet, snapped Oracle. Indeed, you are not. What will happen to the Queen?
Taliesin shrugged.
She will die, as all die. She is old and tired. Her day is gone. The sorcerer long ago sent a demon to kill her. He made a mistake and cast his spell too close to a gateway. The beast is almost upon her.
Can we not save her?
We are talking of destiny, man, snapped Taliesin. The beast must find her.
His stern expression relaxed.
Even should the demon fail, she will die soon. Her heart is old and worn out. At least she achieved something with her life. She saved her people. I've destroyed mine. I cannot make it easier, for you speak the truth. But it is done now.
Is there truly no hope? Oracle pleaded. The druid sighed and stood, gathering his long staff.
There is always hope, no matter how slender or unrealistic. Do not think that you are the only one to feel regret. The Farlane are my people, in a way you could never comprehend. When they are destroyed, my life goes with them, and all the works of my life. You are just a man who made a mistake. I must bear the cost. Hope? I'll tell you what hope there is. Imagine a man standing in Atta Forest at the birth of autumn. Imagine all the leaves are ready to fall. That man must reach out and catch one leaf, one special leaf, but he doesn't know which tree it is on. That is the hope for the Farlane. You think the idiot Campbell will catch the leaf?
Caswallon might, said Oracle.
Caswallon is not Hunt Lord, said Taliesin softly. And if he were... The clans are sundered and widely spread. They will not turn back an enemy as strong as the Aenir.
Did you come here to punish me, Druid?
Punish you? I sometimes wish I had killed you, said Taliesin sadly. Damn you, mortal. Why did I ever show you the gate?
Oracle turned away from him then, leaning forward to add fuel to the fire. When he looked back, the Druid had gone. And he had taken the sword.
You are a little unfair on Caswallon, Meg told her father as he sat in the wide leather chair, chuckling as the infant Donal tugged at his beard. Magrig was well into middle age, but he was still powerful, and his thick red beard showed no grey. Donal yawned, and the Paladies Hunt Lord brought the babe to his chest, resting him in the crook of his arm.
Unfair to him, he said, keeping his voice low. He married my only daughter. And still he raids my herds.
He does not.
I'll grant you he stayed out of Paladin's lands recently, but only because the Aenir have cut off his market.
It is tradition, father, argued Meg. Other clans have always been fair game, and Caswallon is Farlane.
Don't give me that, girl. That tradition died out years ago. By God, he doesn't need to raid my cattle or Larrick's, and sooner or later someone will catch him. Do you think I want to hang my own son-in-law?
Meg lifted the sleeping child from Magrig's arms, laying him in his crib and covering him.
He needs excitement. He does it because he enjoys it.
The word sounded lame even to Meg. For all his intelligence and quick wit, Caswallon refused to grow up.
He used to enjoy taking other men's wives, I hear, said Magrig.
Meg turned on him, eyes flashing.
Enough of that! She snapped. He's not looked at another woman since we wed. Well, he's looked, but that's all.
I can't think why you married him. Did you know he's got my prize bull in the meadow behind the house? Now there's a sight to greet a visitor, his own stolen bull.
Take it with you when you go, said Meg, smiling.
And be seen by all the men of the Farlane. The sooner they thought it was a present.
He shook his head.
I thought you'd change him, Meg. I thought marriage would settle him.
It has. He's a wonderful husband. He cares for me.
I don't want to kill him,
admitted Magrig.
Damn it all, I like the boy. There must be another way to get excitement.
I'll talk to him again. Are you sure that's your bull?
Sure. Of course I'm sure. The night he took it, Intosh and seven others chased him for hours. Only he and that damn crofter Arcus had split up. Caswell and Ledin tossed a merry run.
He must have been furious, said Meg, keeping the smile from her face.
He promised to have Caswellan's ears for a necklace.
That wasn't because of the bull, said his daughter. It is said that when Intosh came back to his house, he found his bed had been slept in and his best sword stolen.
The man is unreasonable, said Magrig, unable to suppress a grin. I gave Intosh that sword after he won the games.
Shall I get it for you, father? I'm sure Intosh would like it back.
He'd bury it in the pig's droppings rather than use it now.
Caswellan plans to wear it at the games.
Ye gods, woman! Has he no shame?
None that I've noticed. From the hearthroom below, they heard a door open and close, and the sound of whistling floated up the stairs.
Well, I suppose I'd better see him, said Magrig, pushing himself to his feet.
Be nice, said Meg, linking her arm with his.
Be nice, she says. What should I say? Been on any good raids lately?
Meg chuckled, looped her arm round his neck and kissed his bearded cheek. I love you, she told him.
He grinned at her. I was too soft on the raising of you, child. You always had what you wanted.
The two of them walked downstairs, where Caswellan was standing before the hearth, hands stretched out to the flames. He turned and smiled, green eyes twinkling.
How are you, father? He asked. Not a great deal better for seeing you, you thieving swine, snapped Magrig.
Meg sighed and left them together.
Is that any way to talk to the husband of your daughter? Caswellan asked. It was a miserable day when you crossed my doorway, said Magrig, walking to the far table and pouring a goblet of honey mead.
It was full-flavoured and rich, and he savoured the taste.
This is a familiar feel to it, he said. It is not unlike the special mead that Intosh brews.
Really? Said Caswellan.
Magrig closed his eyes. That is all I need to complete my day. My own bull grazing in your meadow while I drink mead stolen from my comrade.
You must give him my compliments. It is the finest mead I've tasted.
I'll do that. Where is Galen?
I've sent him out to meet the other lads.
Was that wise?
The smile faded from Caswellan's mouth as he moved to Magrig's side and poured himself a goblet of mead.
It had to happen sooner or later, he said,
gesturing Magrig to a chair. Sitting opposite him, Caswellan gazed at the golden liquid, then sipped at it slowly.
He's a good boy, Magrig, but he's been through much. I think they'll make him suffer. Agwain will lead them. Then why send them? Because he has to learn. That's what life is, learning how to survive. All his life he's done that. Now he must find out that life in the mountains is no different.
You sound bitter. It is not like you.
Well, the world is changing, said Caswellan. I watched the Aenir sack Arteris, and it was vile. They kill like foxes in a henhouse. I hear you had words with them in the mountains.
Caswellan grinned.
Yes. You killed two?
I did. I had no choice.
Will they attack the clans, do you think?
It is inevitable.
I agree with you. Have you spoken to Campbell?
Caswellan laughed aloud.
The man hates me. If I said good day, he would take it as an insult. Then talk to Leofas. Make plans.
I think I will. He's a good man. Strong.
More than that, said Magrig. He's canny.
He sounds like you, Magrig.
He is.
Then I'll see him, and he needn't worry about your herds.
Those days are behind me. After watching Arteris, I lost my appetite for the game. I'm glad to hear it.
Caswellan refilled their goblets. Of course, I might just sneak back for some more of Intosh's mead.
I wouldn't advise it, said Magrig.
Chapter 3 Gwalchmai listened as Agwain planned the downfall of the Lowlander. Around the Huntlord's son, In a wide circle sat 15 other youngsters, the sons of councilmen who would one day be councillors themselves. They listened as Egwene spoke and offered no objections. Gwalchmai wasn't happy with such conversation. An orphan child of the mountains, he knew what loneliness was, the pain it brought, and the inner chill. He'd always been popular, but then he worked at it, jesting and joking, seeking approval from his peers. He ran errands for the older boys, always willing to help in any chore, but in his heart his fears were great. His father had died when he was 7, killed while poaching Paladin's lands. His mother contracted lung fever the following year, and her passing had been painful. Little Gwalchmai had been sent to live with Bordrig and his son, and they had made him welcome. But Gwalchmai had loved his parents deeply, and their loss hurt him beyond his ability to cope. He was not a big child, and though he approached 15, he was by far the smallest of his group. He excelled in 2 things, running and bowmanship, but his lack of strength held him back in both. At short distances he could outpace even Egwene, and with a child's bow at 20 paces he could outshoot the Farland's best archers. But he had not the strength to draw a man's bow, and failed in tourneys when the distance grew beyond 30 paces. Egwene was talking now about humiliating Caswellan's new son. Gwalchmai sat and stared at the Hunt Lord's son. He was tall and graceful, with a quick and dazzling smile, and normally there was little malice in him. But not today. Egwene's dark eyes glittered, and his handsome face was marred as he spoke of tormenting the lowlander. Gwalchmai found it hard to understand, and he longed to find the courage to speak out. But when he looked inside himself, he knew that his nerve would fail him. Nervously, his eyes sought out Lane. While all others would follow Egwene blindly, Lane would always go his own way. At that moment, the son of Leofas was saying nothing, his aquiline face showing no emotion. Beside him, his giant brother Lennox was also silent. Lane's grey eyes met Gwalchmai's gaze, and the orphan boy willed Lane to speak out. As if in answer to prayer, Lane smiled at Gwalchmai, then spoke. "I think this Gaelan has already been harshly treated, Egwene," said Lane. "Why make it worse for him?" Gwalchmai felt relief flow through him, but Egwene was not to be persuaded. "We are talking about a jest," said Egwene smoothly. "I'm not suggesting we kill him. Where's the harm?" Lane ran a hand through his long dark hair, his eyes holding Agwain's gaze. "Where is the good in it?" he cantered. "Such an action is beneath you, cousin. It is well known that your father has no love for Caswellan, but that is a matter for the two of them." "This has nothing to do with my father," said Egwene angrily. He swung to Lennox. "What about you?" he asked. "Decide with your brother." Lennox shrugged his huge shoulders. "Always," he said, his voice deep as distant thunder. "Do you never think for yourself, you ugly ox?" snapped Egwene. "Sometimes," answered Lennox amiably. "What about the rest of you?" "Oh, let's have a little fun with him," said Drigg, Gwalchmai's foster brother. "Where's the harm? What do you think, Wal?" All eyes turned to Gwalchmai, and his heart sank. He spent his life avoiding argument, and now whatever he said would hurt him. Lane and Lennox were his friends. Lane was stern of nature but a loyal youth, and his brother Lennox, so strong as an ox, was a gentle companion. But Egwene was Campbell's son, and the accepted leader of the Farland youth. And Drake was Gwalchmai's foster brother, and a boy given to hot temper and malice-bearing. Of the other 5, all were larger than Gwalchmai. "Well, what do you think?" urged Drake.
"I don't mind," mumbled Gwalchmai.
"Whatever you think best." He tried not to look at Lane, but his eyes were drawn to the other's gaze. Lane merely smiled at him, and he felt the pity in that smile. It hurt him more than he could bear.
"Then let's do it," said Egwene, grinning.
The plan was a simple one. Corrine had innocently told them that Caswallon planned to send his son to the meadow that morning to meet the other boys of the village. Egwene had suggested they take his clothes and chase him back to his house, lashing him the while with birch sticks. Now Lane and Lennox moved away from the group to lounge on the grass. Gwalchmai sat miserably on a fallen tree, wishing he had stayed at home. He looked up as the conversation died. Coming towards them was a slender boy in a green woolen tunic, edged with brown leather. His hair was red, with a white flash above the jagged scar which ran down the left side of his face. He wore a wide belt and from it hung a hunting knife. There was no swagger in his walk, but he seemed nervous. Lane and Lennox ignored him as he passed, and Gwalchmai saw the boy's jaw was clamped tight. He approached the group, with eyes fixed on Egwene. Gwalchmai saw that his left eye was filled with blood, and he shivered. "I am Galen," said the boy, addressing Egwene. Egwene nodded. "Why tell me?" "I see from the way your friends are grouped around you that you are the leader. How observant of you, Lowlander. Will you tell me your name? To what purpose?" "You will never address us directly. You are like the wolf pup you brought home, of no account to those with pedigree." Galen said nothing, but his mind raced. In Archeris there had been many thieves and many gangs, but he had always been alone. This scene was no different from many in his life. There would be a little more talk, then tempers would grow and the violence would begin. The difference was that in Archeris he always had somewhere to run. He knew every alley and tall building, every rooftop and hiding place. As he had approached the group, he had scanned them, making judgments, deciding which were the boys to be feared, which to be ignored. Two were lounging on the grass away from their comrades. One of these was slender but athletically built, his face strong. Beside him was a veritable giant, bigger than most clansmen Galen had seen. But since they were apart from the group, Galen ignored them. His eyes had been drawn to a small boy, sitting with the others. Slight of build with short-cropped ginger hair, he had seemed nervous, frightened. Galen put this one from his mind. The others had gathered around the young man now facing him. They would not act, only react. Therefore everything depended on the outcome of this confrontation with the leader. Galen took stock of him. His face was strong, the eyes dark, the gaze steady. And he was proud. In that instant Galen knew that he was facing no cowardly bully who could be browbeaten or dominated by words. His heart sank. Still, one thing he had learned early was that you never allow the enemy to dictate the pace of the game. "Well, don't just stand there," he told Egwene, forcing a grin. "Teach the wolf pup the lesson you have planned." "What?" said Egwene, momentarily taken aback. "It's obvious that you and your mongrel playmates have already decided how this game is going to be played, so let's be at it. Here, I'll make it easy for you." Casually, he stepped forward and then, with a lack of speed that dulled Agwain's reflexes, punched the other boy full in the face, toppling him backwards to the grass. Galen drew his knife and leapt back as the other youths surged to their feet. Egwene shook his head and slowly rose, eyes glittering. He too drew a knife. "I'll kill you for that, Outlander," he said. His face was set, and he moved forward perfectly in balance. The other youths drew their blades, spreading out in a half-circle. "That's enough," said the tall young man Galen had seen sitting apart from the others. Walking forward, he stood by Galen. "In fact, it's more than enough. The joke has soured, Egwene." Another figure moved to the other side of Galen. He was enormous, towering above all the other youths. "Do not interfere," Egwene warned them. "I mean to cut his heart out." "Move behind me," Lane told Galen. "I'm not afraid of him." "Move behind me." The voice was not raised, and yet had great authority. Even so, Galen's anger was so great now that he was ready to refuse. Then the giant laid a massive hand on his shoulder, and Galen felt the power in the grip.
"Best to do as he says,"
said the huge youth softly.
Lane's usually right.
Galen obeyed, and Lane stepped forward until his stomach pressed against Agwain's dagger.
"Do you really want to kill me, cousin?"
he asked.
"You know I will not."
"Then think on it. The boy did well. He knew you planned to thrash him, and he took you all on. He has courage. It would not be fitting to punish him now, would it?"
Agwain sheathed his blade. "He is a lowlander, and I will never accept him. Neither will my friends. He will be shunned by all who follow me."
"I'll not shun him, Agwain."
"Neither will Lennox."
"Then you are my friend no longer." "Let's go,"
he told the others. As they trooped away, Gwalchmai hung back, but Drigg spotted him and called out.
"I'll see you later,"
Gwalchmai replied. Drigg trotted back to his side.
"You can't stay here," he said. "You heard what Agwain said."
"I stay with my friends,"
said Gwalchmai.
"You're a fool, Gwal. No good will come of it."
Drigg strode off. Galen slid the knife back in its sheath. The tall youth with the dark hair and grey eyes turned to him, holding out his hand.
"I am Lane, son of Leofas," he said. "This is my brother, Lennox, and my cousin, Gwalchmai."
Galen shook hands with them all. "Why did you do this for me?" he asked.
"It wasn't for you. It was for Agwain,"
Lane told him. "I don't understand."
"Agwain is a fine friend and a brave one," said Lane. "He acted in anger and would have regretted slaying you. He's not evil, not malicious, but he has the conceit of his father, and he loves to lead."
"I have caused you trouble. For that I am sorry." Lane shook his head.
"You caused nothing. It was not you that they were seeking to humble, but your father. Caswellan is not liked."
"Why?"
"It is not for me to prattle on with gossip. I like Caswellan, but others do not, and among the clan such matters usually end in bloodshed and family feuds. We are a violent race, Galen, as you have discovered."
"Caswellan is not violent."
"Indeed he is not, but he has the capacity for it, as you saw in the mountains with the Anir."
"You heard of that?
Who has not? My father led the hunters that escorted them from the Farlan."
The lads settled themselves on the grass, enjoying the sunshine. Lennox and the ginger-haired Gwalchmai said little. Lane asked Galen about life in Arteris and the Anir invasion. Galen found the memories too painful and switched the conversation back to Caswellan. "I know you don't want to gossip," he said, "but I'm a stranger here, and I need to know how my father earned such dislike."
"Caswellan is the richest man in the valley. He has the largest herds, and his fields carry more wheat than any save Campbell's. But he holds himself apart from other clansmen, and the hunt lord hates him."
"He doesn't appear rich," said Galen.
"In Arteris, rich men have had marble palaces and carriages of gold, and many servants. There were rings and necklets, bracelets and brooches."
"We have no use for such finery," Lane told him.
"We live free. Caswellan supports more than 100 crofters. If he desired, he could start a new clan. That is rich, believe me."
"Then why doesn't he? I mean, if he so disliked, it would seem to be good sense. Then he would be his own hunt lord.
He would have to surrender his valley land and find somewhere else to live, and that is no longer easy. To the northeast, the Hasten control the land bordering the lowlands. North of them are the Palades. The rest of the land for a six-day march is all Farlan, and beyond that, the minor clans, the Loda, the Dunnels, and the Ireless, fight over territory. Anyway, Caswellan is Farlan, and always will be."
"I'm damned hungry," said Lennox suddenly.
Galen fished in his leather hip pouch and produced a thick slice of cold meat pie. He passed it to Lennox. Thanking him, the youth wolfed the pie down at speed.
"My father would also be rich," said Lane dryly, "were it not for my brother's appetite."
"He's big," said Galen. I don't think I've seen anyone his age bigger. Lennox was already more than 6 feet tall, with a bull-like neck and an enormous frame. His face was broad, his eyes deep-set and brown. His chin and cheeks were already darkening with the promise of a beard. And as strong as he looks. Also, despite what you will hear, he's no fool. He just says little. Isn't that right, brother?
Whatever you see, said Lennox, grinning.
I don't know why, but he likes to play the fool, said Lane. He lets people think he has no brains.
It does no harm, said Lennox mildly.
No, but it irritates me, replied his brother, scowling. Galen would not have guessed them to be brothers. Lane, though tall, was of a more slender build, his face fine-boned.
I can't think why it should, Lane, said Lennox, smiling. You are the thinker in the family.
Nonsense! Lane swung to Gwalchmai. Why so silent, little one?
I was thinking about Agwin, answered Gwalchmai. I don't like to make anyone angry.
He won't be angry with you for long, and besides, I'm proud of you.
What do you think, Lennox?
I think it took nerve to stay with us. You'll not regret it, Gwal, my lad.
Do you think they'll attack Galen again? Gwal asked.
No, replied Lane. When he has had time to think on it, Agwin will realize that Galen acted like...
He grinned. Like a Highlander, he said. He will respect that. Galen blushed and said nothing.
Well, said Lane, I think it's time we told Galen about the hunt.
Caswallon stood nervously outside the door, biting his lip, a habit he thought he had left behind in childhood. But then, standing before the door of Leofas, brought back memories, none of them pleasant. When Caswallon was a child, he had stolen a dagger from the home of the sword champion Leofas. His foster father, Pardris, had been furious when Campbell informed him of Caswallon's misbehaviour and had sent the boy to Leofas to confess. Caswallon had stood before the door then, as now, on edge and fearful. The clansman chuckled.
You fool, he told himself,
but it didn't help. Leofas let him in without a word of greeting and pointed to a chair before the hearth. Removing his cloak, Caswallon sat down. The room was large, strewn with rugs of goatskin and wolfhide, and on the far wall hung a bearskin, dust-covered and patchy with age. Caswallon stretched out his legs before the fire.
The last time I was here, you thrashed me with your belt, he remarked. I recall that you deserved it, said Leofas.
He was a big man, not tall, but wide in the shoulder with a thick neck and heavy beard streaked with grey. But his blue eyes were keen, the stare forbidding.
Indeed I did. State your business, Caswallon, snapped the older man.
Caswallon pushed himself to his feet, a knot of anger deep within him.
I don't think that I will, he said softly. I am not the child who stole your knife. I am a man. I came here because Margaret advised it, and it seemed sensible, but I'll not sit here swallowing your discourtesies.
Leofas raised his eyebrows, waiting as Caswallon reached for his cloak.
Would you like a drink, boy?
He asked. Caswallon hesitated for a moment, then dropped his cloak across the back of a chair and turned to the older man.
That would be pleasant, he said.
Leofas left the room, returning with two jugs of ale. Then he sat opposite Caswallon.
Now will you state your business? Before I do, let's clear the air. When you were young, you raided all over the Druin to build your herds. So why are you set against me?
That's easy answered. I like a man who states his grievance swiftly. When I was a lad, there was open warfare between the clans. No man knew what it was like to be rich. Raiding was often the difference between starvation and small comfort. But times changed, and clans prospered. I applauded you when you began. I thought you were spirited and cunning. But then you grew rich, and yet the raids continued. And then I knew that the raids were not a means to an end, but the end itself. Sometimes in life, a man must risk death for the sake of his family, but you risk it merely for pleasure. Most men in the mountains value their clan, for it is like a great family, and we depend on one another to survive. Children of the mountain are cared for. No man starves while another gluts himself. But you, Caswellan, you don't care. You avoid responsibility, and your very existence eats away at what makes the clan strong. Children imitate you. They tell tales of your exploits, and they want to be like you, for you are exciting, like a clansman out of time, a myth from the past. Cuckoo Caswellan, they used to call you, because of your amorous exploits. Women yearn for you, and I can understand that and don't begrudge it. But when you creep into the bed of another man's wife and sire him a son, all you have done is destroy that man's life. He cared for his wife deeply, loved her and cherished her. She surrenders all that for a few nights of passion with you. You don't stick by her, so she despairs, and her life is ruined too. As for your raids, you encourage other clans to copy you. Last autumn, I caught 3 Palades poachers making off with my prize bull. I had to mutilate them. It was the law, but why did they do it? Why? Because Caswellan had stolen their bull. Now state your business.
Caswellan leaned back in his chair. His heart was heavy, for he could not refute a word of Leofas's damning indictment.
Not yet, Leofas. First, let me say this. Everything you accuse me of is correct, and I cannot gainsay it. But I never intended evil. Cuckoo, Caswellan. Sometimes a man gives in to selfishness, telling himself there is a nobler reason. He is bringing a little happiness into a dull life. But since I married Meg, I have been faithful, for I learned by my mistakes. As for the reeds, they too were selfish, but I don't regret them, for I enjoyed every moment. If men suffered by imitating me, then it is on their heads, for my risk was as great as theirs. But that, too, is now a thing of the past. I came to you because of the Aeneir. That is my business with you. I seek not your friendship nor your approval. I care for neither. The Aeneir are killers, and they will invade the clans.
Campbell is hunt lord, said Leofas guardedly. Have you seen him?
You know I have not, nor will I. If I told Campbell that sheep ate grass, he would deny it and feed his flock on beef.
The older man nodded.
That is true enough, and I agree with you about the Aeneir. But Campbell thinks differently. He seeks new trade agreements, and he has invited an Aeneir captain to watch the hunt.
He didn't see the sack of Artoris, said Caswellan.
No, but you did, and it changed you. I won't deny that. How's the boy you brought home?
He is well. Your lads helped him, I think, though he's not spoken of it.
Neither have they, but I heard. They're good boys. Lane would not allow Agwain to harm him, and Lennox stood by him. That made me proud, for it's hard bringing up boys without a mother, and they've turned out well.
They are a credit to you,
as is Galen to you, said Leofas, for he took them all on.
He is a credit to himself.
Will you argue against Campbell on the council?
On the question of the Aeneir, I will.
Then I'll take up no more of your time.
Man, you haven't finished your ale. Sit and be comfortable for a while. I don't get many visitors.
For an hour or more, the men sat, drinking ale and swapping stories. It came to Caswellan that the older man was lonely. His wife had died 6 years before, and he had never taken another. On the death of Padris 3 years ago, Leofas had refused to stand for Hunt Lord, claiming it was a young man's duty. But he remained on the Hunt Council, and his words were heeded.
How long do you think we have before they invade? Asked Leofas suddenly, his eyes clear despite the jugs of ale.
Caswellan fought to clear his mind. I'd say 1 year, maybe 2, but I could be wrong.
I don't think so. They're still fighting in the lowlands. Several cities are holding out.
We need a plan of our own, said Caswellan. The valley is indefensible.
Seek out Taliesin,
Leofas advised.
I know these druids raise the hairs on a man's neck, but he is wise, and he knows much about events outside Druin.
For 2 months, Caswellan took Galen with him on every hunt, teaching him more of the land and the creatures of the land. He taught him to fight hand to hand, and to wrestle and to box, to roll with the punches, and to counter swiftly. The lessons were sometimes painful, and Galen was quick to anger. Caswellan taught him to hold his fury and use it coolly.
Anger can strengthen a man or destroy him, he told the youth as they sat on the hillside above the house. When you fight, you stay cool. Think with your hands. When you strike a blow, it should surprise you as well as your opponent. Now pad your hands and we will see what you have understood.
Warily the two circled one another. Caswellan stabbed a straight left to Galen's face. Galen blocked it, hurling a right. Caswellan leaned out of reach, the punch whistling past his chin. He countered with a swift left that glanced from the boy's jaw. Off balance, Galen hit the ground hard, rolled and rose to his feet with eyes blazing. Caswellan stepped in to meet him, throwing a right cross. It never landed, for Galen ducked inside the punch and caught the taller man with an uppercut that sent him reeling in the grass.
Good. That was good, said Caswellan, rubbing his jaw. You're beginning to move well. A little too well.
Reaching up, he took Galen's hand, and the younger man pulled him to his feet.
Let's sit for a while, he said. My head is still spinning. I think you've shaken all my teeth.
I'm sorry.
Caswellan laughed. Don't be. You were angry, but you kept it under control and used the power of your anger in your punch. That was excellent.
The two sat together beneath the shade of an elm. There is something I've been meaning to ask you, said Galen. About the bush you hid me in when the Aenir were close?
It was a good hiding place.
But it wasn't, insisted Galen. It was out in the open, and had they looked down, they would surely have seen me.
That's why it was good. When they attacked, their blood was up. They were moving fast, thinking fast, seeing fast. You understand? They didn't examine the clearing. They scanned it swiftly, making judgments at speed. The bush was small and, as you see, in plain sight. It offered little cover and was the last place, so they believed that anyone would choose as a hiding place. Therefore, they ignored it. Similarly, that made it the best place to hide in.
I see that, said Galen, but what if they had stopped to examine the clearing?
Then you would probably have been slain, said Caswellan. It could have happened, but the odds were vastly against it.
Most men react to situations of violence or threatened violence by animal instinct. Understanding that instinct allows an intelligent man to win 9 times out of 10. Galen grinned. I do understand, he said. That's why when you raided the Palades you chose to hide in the village itself. You knew they would expect you to flee their lands at speed, and so they raced from their village to catch you.
Ah, you've been listening to the tales of my wicked youth. I hope you learn from them.
I am learning, agreed Galen. But why did you choose the House of Intosh to hide in? He's the sword champion of the Palades, and everyone says he's a fearsome opponent.
He is also a widower with no children. No one would be in the house.
So you had it planned, even before you did it? You must have scouted the village first.
Always have a plan, Galen. Always.
Later, as they sat on the hillside above Caswellan's house, awaiting the call to the midday meal, Caswellan asked the boy how he was settling in with the other lads in the small village. Very well, Galen told him guardedly.
No problems?
None that I can't handle.
Of that I have no doubt. How do they compare with the boys of Arteris?
Galen smiled. In the city, I used to watch them play games. Hunt-seek, spider's folly, shadow man.
Here, they play nothing. They're so serious. I like that. But I always wanted to join in back in Arteris. Caswellan nodded.
You joined us a little late for children's games, Galen. Here in the mountains, a boy becomes a man at 16, free to wed and make his own life. It is not easy. 2 in 5 babes die before their first birthday, and few are the men who reach 50 years of age. Childhood passes more swiftly here. Have you teamed yet for the hunt next week?
Yes, I travel with Gwalchmai, Lennox and Lane.
Fine boys, said Caswellan, although Gwalchmai's a little timid, I think. Are you content with the teaming?
Yes. We are meeting today to plan the run. What problems will you face?
Lennox is strong, but no runner. We may not beat Agwain's team to the first tree.
Speed is not everything, said Caswellan.
I know.
Which of you will lead?
We're deciding that this afternoon, but I think it will be Lane.
Logical. Lane is a bright fellow.
Not as bright as Agwain, said Galen.
No, but you are. You should enjoy yourselves.
Did you lead when you ran in the hunt?
No, Campbell led.
Did you win?
Yes.
Was Campbell a good leader?
In his way. He still is, and he has been a good hunt lord for the Farland.
But he doesn't like you, Caswellan. Everyone knows that.
You shouldn't listen to idle chatter. But you are right. He doesn't like me. But then he has good cause. 3 years ago, I robbed him of something. I didn't mean to, but it worked out that way and he's not forgotten.
What did you steal? Asked Galen.
I didn't actually steal anything. I just refused to stand against him for the position of hunt lord. I didn't want the role, so he was voted to it by the elders.
I don't understand. How can he hold that against you?
That's a difficult question, Galen. Many people assumed I would try for hunt lord. In truth, I would have lost, for Campbell is and always was worthy of the role. But had I stood and lost, he would have known he was considered the better man. Because I did not stand, he will never know.
Is that why Agwain doesn't like me? Asked Galen. Because his father doesn't like you?
Perhaps. I have been very selfish in my life, doing only that which I enjoyed. I should have acted differently. If I am nominated for the council again, I shall accept. But that is not likely.
From the house below, they heard Corrine calling. Galen waved at her, but Caswellan remained where he was.
Go and eat, he said.
I will be down soon. He watched the boy running down the hillside and smiled, remembering his own hunt day 15 years before.
Every lad in the Farland over the age of 14 and not yet a man was teamed with 3 others and sent out into the mountains to recover a treasure. Skillful hunters would lay trails, hide clues and signs, and the teams would track them down until at last one team returned with a prize. For Caswellan, the prize they had sought was a dagger hidden in a tree. Often it was an arrow or a lance or a helm or a shield. This year it was a sword, though none of the lads knew it. Every year, Caswellan helped lay the trails and delighted in his work. But this year was special for him, for Galen would be taking part. He removed from his pouch the strip of parchment Taliesin had given him, and he re-read the words written there.
Seek the beast that no one finds, always roaring, never silent, beneath his skin, by silver wings, bring forth the long-lost dream of kings.
After the meal, Caswellan would read the verse to his new son, even as all over the Farland, fathers would be doing likewise. There were times, Caswellan considered, when tradition was a wholesome thing. In the wide kitchen, Caswellan's young son, Donal, lay on a woolen blanket by the hearth. Beside him slept the pup Galen had brought home. It had grown apace in the last 2 months, showing signs of the formidable beast it would be in the years ahead. Corrine sat beside Meg opposite Galen.
and they were all laughing as Caswellan entered.
"And what is amusing you?" he asked.
"Rest your poor bones at the table," Meg told him, "and tell us, gently, how Galen here dumped you to the earth."
"It was a wicked blow, and I was unprepared," he answered, seating himself beside the boy, who was blushing furiously.
"Have you been bragging, young Galen?" he asked.
"He has not," said Meg. "Corinne herself saw the deed done as she fed the chickens."
"Fed the chickens, indeed," said Caswellan. "Could not be seen from the yard. The lazy child climbed the hill and spied on us for a certainty."
Now Corinne began to blush, casting a guilty glance at Meg.
"In fact," said Caswellan, smiling broadly, "on my way back here, I saw two sets of tracks. One had the dainty footprints of young Corinne. The other I could not make out except to say the feet must have been uncommonly large."
"So," said Meg, "it's back to jibes about my feet, is it?"
"You have beautiful feet, Meg, my love. There isn't a woman in the Farland who could match them for their beauty or their length."
Throughout the meal, they good-naturedly sniped at each other, and only when she began to list Caswellan's faults did he open his arms in surrender and beg her forgiveness.
"Woman," he said, "you're full of venom."
After the meal, he gave leave to Galen to seek his friends and read him the druid's parchment.
"Do not be late home. We've an early start tomorrow."
Later, as Meg and Caswellan lay arm in arm in the broad bed, she leaned over him and kissed him gently on the lips.
"What troubles you, my love?" she asked him, stroking his dark hair back from his eyes.
His arm circled her back, pulling her to him.
"What makes you think I am troubled?"
"No games, Caswellan," she said seriously. She rolled from him, and he sat up, bunching a pillow behind him.
"The council voted to resume trade with Arteris and allow an Anir group to visit the Farlan."
"But we had to trade with them," said Meg. "We've always dealt with Arteris for iron, seed corn, seasoned timbers, leather."
"We didn't always, Meg. We used to do these things ourselves. We're no longer dealing with merchant lowlanders. This is a warrior race. What harm can it do to allow a few of them to visit us? We might become friends." "You don't make friends with a wolf by inviting it to sleep with a sheep."
"But we are not sheep, Caswellan. We are the clans."
"I think the decision is short-sighted, and we may live to rue it."
"I love you," she said,
the words cutting through his thoughts.
"I can't think why," he said, chuckling.
Then he reached for her, and they lay silently enjoying the warmth of each other's bodies and the closeness of their spirits.
"I cannot begin to tell you what you mean to me," he whispered.
"You don't have to," she said.
One moment the mountainside was clear, rolling green slopes, the occasional tree, two streams meeting and foaming over white boulders, sheep grazed quietly near a small herd of wild ponies. Suddenly, the air reeked with an acrid smell none of the animals recognized. Their heads came up. Blue light replaced the gold of the sun. Rainbows danced on the grass, and a great noise, like locust wings, covered the mountainside. The ponies reared and wheeled, the sheep scattering in all directions. For a fraction of a second, two suns hung in the sky. Then they merged, and the golden sunlight bathed the mountain. But all was not as it had been. In the shadow of a great boulder stood a towering figure, 6-inch fangs curving from a wide snout, massive shoulders covered in black fur, huge arms ending in taloned fingers. The eyes were black and round, the brows deep, and it blinked as its new surroundings came into focus. Lifting its shaggy head, the beast sniffed the air. The sweet smell of living flesh flooded its senses. The creature leaned forward, dipping its colossal shoulders until its talons brushed the earth. Its eyes focused on a 3-year-old ewe, which stood trembling on the hillside. dropping fully to all fours. The beast bunched the muscles of its hind legs and leapt forward, bearing down on the sheep with terrible speed. Startled, the ewe turned to run,